I'm Elizabeth Hill, in for Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In 1940s Cambridge, Massachusetts, a religious community called the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary was formed. The center's members, many of them highly educated and later ostracized for their beliefs, surrendered all earthly possessions and aspects of their lives, including their children, to their leader, Leonard Feeney, a controversial Catholic priest who was later excommunicated. Patricia Walsh Chadwick and her family were original members of this community. In her book, Little Sister, a Memoir, Chadwick opens up about her upbringing, leaving the sect, and launching a successful career on Wall Street.
It was an uber-Catholic organization that held very strongly to one dogma of the Catholic Church, which was that you had to be Catholic to get to heaven. But this was at a time when the Catholic Church was trying to become a little more ecumenical. So this very small group of about 50 grown-ups who founded this were really going contra to what the Catholic Church was trying to espouse at that point in time, but they would not give up on that program. Among those 50-odd people were couples who were married and some of whom had children. And over the next 5 or 6 years, those couples ended up having 39 children, so that we became a group by 1955 of about 100 people, religious and yet in many cases married. I mean, for me, it was a fabulous environment because I had all these what I will call uncles and aunts, all these 50 or 60 grown-ups with whom I would spend the day reading with them or playing with them or having meals with them. Everything was done communally. And in fact, as part of this religious group, all of the adults sold whatever possessions they had and contributed them to the group. And my father and mother had bought a three-family house on the GI Bill. My father had been teaching at Boston College, along with two other professors. And they were fired for holding on to this dogma of the Catholic Church, which was really what inspired creating this religious organization. So we lived as a commune of sorts, and pretty soon the adults no longer wore what we called worldly clothes. They dressed in black. And then we all had to change our names. And so I didn't end up speaking to my parents as Mummy and Daddy. My mother was Sister Elizabeth Ann, and my father was Brother James Aloysius. And then the leader of this group, Father Feeney, a renowned Jesuit, he started changing the children's names as well. And so my name, which was Mary Patricia, and which I loved as a name, I became Anastasia. By the time I was 6 years old, we had become such a religiously centric organization. And then came the blow that I still can hardly get over, was the day when the children, all of the children 3 years or older, so I was six and I had a sister and a brother that were 3 years older, and I had two more baby sisters that were under 3 years old. But all of those of us who were 3 years old or older were separated from our parents, and we had to live dormitory style, being overseen by one of the women. And the women were called big sisters, the men big brothers, and the girls little sisters, so the title of the book, and the little boys little brothers.
And was it different for you as a young woman than, say, your brother as a young man?
The rules were applied the same, but it was more difficult for certain children. My sister Kathy, who was only four, felt this terribly. I mean, I was older, and I also felt that it was my responsibility to take care of her. But the fact of the matter is, she stopped eating, for which she was punished. So I would find ways of eating her food when she couldn't eat her food. And the boys and the girls were completely separate. The woman that ran the girls was a tyrant. There is no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And the boys, probably, they were treated maybe a little easier than the girls because this woman was such a draconian leader. We would have to go in and kneel down and be criticized by everyone else, which would drive me crazy because I was just a high-spirited child and was forever getting into trouble. And she had this huge plank that she would beat us with. And sometimes she just used her open hand and, you know, slapped our faces. And I got used to it. It was the regime. It wasn't what I wanted. And the interesting thing was I didn't want my parents to find out because I felt that they would be upset and I didn't want to upset them.
How did the cult evolve over time from its conception?
The place was run by this priest, charismatic priest, actually, but once he lost his faculties as a Catholic priest, and after he harangued the Jews and Protestants and even Catholics who didn't support him, he lost a lot of his following. And the person that was his right-hand person was a woman named Catherine Clark, and she became Sister Catherine when everybody changed their names. And by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, she had taken over from Leonard Feeney, and it was she who made all the rules and made all the determinations. And she decided that we needed to leave Cambridge. We were literally right in the heart of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And most of these members were either Harvard or Radcliffe students. These were highly educated, in some cases, brilliant people. But they fell for this particular dogma of the Catholic faith. And so in 1958, when I was 9 years old, we moved to Still River, Massachusetts, which is a little bit west of Concord, so call it 30 miles west of where we had been. And it was then that Sister Catherine came into her supremacy. We became even more segregated as a family. Now we were no longer even allowed to speak to our parents. And the girls and boys and the big sisters lived in one house and the men lived in another. And despite the fact there were these incredibly brilliant and educated men, none of them was allowed to teach in the school. That doesn't mean we didn't have some very good teachers. We did. But Sister Catherine wanted complete control, and quite obviously she did not trust the men. She wanted complete control over the formation of our lives. And what she was doing was training us to become, as she told us, the bride of Christ. So we were told as children that we were the luckiest 39 children in the whole world because from our birth we had been dedicated to God. And I, as this young, energetic, and curious child, kept thinking that I don't want to be dedicated to God. I want to find a prince, and I want to be married, and I want to have a beautiful house and gardens. And as I was getting older, I could see that this was not the path that was going to be, you know, laid out for me. Sister Catherine was my godmother, and I always thought, well, that should mean I had a special place in her heart. But for some reason, I was her nemesis, and she was a powerful, powerful woman. Nobody would say no to her. So this was really a place that was run by a woman. And when I got to be about 12 or 13 years old, I had my first crush. I didn't even know what it meant and what it was about, because from Sister Catherine's standpoint, there was no need to know that, because I was going to be channeled into being a nun, and what did I need to know about any of those, you know, elements of life that are so important for the procreation of the rest of the world. And as time went on, I had crushes that would move from one person to another, and they were always for the men because the boys were younger than I was. I wasn't interested in any of them. And finally, by the time I was in high school, I had become a postulant, which is the first order of becoming a nun. And I just thought, I don't want this. But I could see that my life was going down a path I had no choice in. And one day when I was a senior in high school, Sister Catherine called me into her office, and with her was my mother. I had never, never been in a room with my mother and Sister Catherine before. And Sister Catherine informed me that not everyone has a vocation to become a nun. And she told it to me in this sweet and charming way, and I'm thinking, I don't even understand what's going on here. And in essence, suddenly I realized I was standing in the room that she was telling me she was kicking me out.
What did you do when you were kicked out? Because you lived in this life of isolation.
I had never seen a television show, never read a newspaper, never seen a magazine, never eaten in a restaurant, never made a phone call, never danced. My gosh, that would have sent me straight to hell. But I had been well educated in a very classical way, and I had been accepted at Vassar and at Bates. And the only reason I was allowed to apply was that the state of Massachusetts told us we needed to get ourselves registered. And it happened to be just at the time that I was a junior and a senior. And I was accepted at those colleges, and then Sister Catherine forced me to write a letter telling them I was not coming. So she's kicking me out, and I am, in essence, kind of abandoned. And for the first 6 months of my being gone, Sister Catherine, knowing full well I'd been accepted at Vassar, but having no intention of ever allowing me to go because she said that the college courses that were being taught would cause me to lose my soul. So she allowed me to go to a secretarial school. And the moment I graduated from that, which was about 8 months after I went, I was on my own. And I had to find a room at the YWCA on the edge of South Boston and learn. The language of the world was completely foreign to me. I had never heard a swear word. I had never even heard a slang word. I didn't know who Frank Sinatra was. One day on a bus, a man whispered to me, "Has anyone ever told you you look like Lauren Bacall?" I didn't have a clue who Lauren Bacall was. And so I was a very silent observer for quite a period of time. And little by little, I learned. I learned with my eyes and my ears, and I kept my mouth shut. After getting out of the secretarial school and working there for a period of time, which was my first job, I went to a placement agency with my credentials, which were simply how fast I could type and how fast I could take shorthand. They said, "We have two jobs for you that you can interview at." One was the Atlantic Monthly, which excited me because I thought, oh, maybe this will give me an opportunity to learn. And the other was a brokerage firm called Ladenburg Thalmann. And that was my first interview. They offered me a job for more money than I'd been making at the secretarial school, and they asked me to start the next day. So I took that job, and that is why I ended up with a career on Wall Street from this brokerage firm. I ended up putting myself through Boston University, and when I moved to New York in 1975, at the age of 26, I was just completing my undergraduate degree in economics. And that at least gave me a sense of, okay, now I'm really maybe part of the real world. But it was from my position as a receptionist that I was able to wend my way through, as I like to say, luck and pluck, and an amazing array of mentors. But as you can well imagine, this was the 60s and 70s, there were no women on Wall Street, very, very, very few. And I did have, in my book, I tell a horrific Me Too story, not with the person that was trying to play mentor to me at all. And I did not write that story in my book until it was the last story. The book was almost ready to go to be published. And I was talking to my agent, and I told him the story. And he said to me, "Write it if you can, and if you want to take it out, we'll just take it out." And in that case, once I wrote that story, I said, the words are on the paper. I've now spoken it. I've gotten it out. It can stay. So it is in my book. I thought at the time that I was 1 in 3 million people. I had no idea. And I don't think a lot of the world had an idea of how much abuse there was, because no one would speak of it. I did not tell my parents for 30 years.
Was it the Me Too movement that gave you the courage to address the incident in your book?
No, because I hadn't heard anybody's stories yet. I did this 6 months before Harvey Weinstein came out.
Oh, okay.
And I was always so ashamed of it. And I will have to admit, even today, with this story in the book, I cringe when I think of people reading it. because I don't want them to see me in that way. On the other hand, I now realize that I was one in three, not one in 3 million, most likely. And so it's the honest truth. And I can deal with it much better. It's been, I think, helpful to readers when I'm engaged, and I engage in a lot of, you know, library events and book club events. I tell the story, and it inevitably brings up responses from people, how they have had the same thing or a similar kind of thing happen to them. And you realize it's just been this, you know, silence among us all.
Yeah.
Because it was, one, so violating. Two, you can't believe it's happened. Three, you think you're the only person because you haven't shared it. Now that it is finally out. And you know what? It's probably been going on for 2,000 years. And women have simply taken it and absorbed it and moved on. And yet, there is trauma that goes with it. There is no doubt that there is trauma. And I must say, one of the wonderful things, so there were 39 children. Sadly, 6 have died. All of them were boys. But once my book came out, more than half of the kids that I grew up with, and I know we're not kids anymore, but have reached out to me and said, thank you for writing the book. And what I did not realize was how many of them have suffered from PTSD.
Yeah.
And how many of them have been in therapy for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And I also found it very interesting something that you said about, you know, it being a cult. The word cult does not appear in my book at all. I wrote my entire book without thinking of it as a cult. For me, the cult was Jim Jones.
Yeah.
Or the Branch Davidians, people that were so far afield, Manson, people like that. But I will tell you, it was my daughter who was in college at about age 20, and she came home one weekend, and she said, Mom, I have two things to tell you. First, you've got to stop everything until you finish this book. And second, she said, you have to accept the fact that you grew up in a cult. It was my daughter who opened my eyes to the fact that it was a cult. And she was 20 years old at the time. And I am still in admiration of her for that. And I think in one way, I am very happy that I did not write the book as I grew up in a cult. I would have been doing contrasting and comparing and all
right,
of that kind of
right.
stuff. I simply told the story. And it was for me then to come to accept the fact that it was a cult.
What was your feelings when Sister Catherine died?
I went up for her funeral. I was aware that she was dying. She had kicked me out, but I had gone back a couple of times before then. And the wake was there, a very Catholic wake. She's lying there in the coffin. And I knelt down in the coffin. Nobody else, everybody else in the room is crying. And I knelt down in front of her, and I looked at her. And then for some reason, I suddenly said, don't open your eyes. Don't sit up. You're gone now, gone for good. I said that to her. And it just spoke to me. And then I got up and I mingled with the rest of the community. And I understood their emotion, but I did not share it. And after she died, the whole place started to fall apart.
Was that what led your parents and your siblings to leave, or did they leave before that?
Nope, it was. Well, I think my own exodus was, of course, the first impetus, but they were the next group of family to leave. And then pretty much all of the children and parents left.
What ended up happening to the slaves to the Immaculate Heart of St. Mary?
Ultimately, they became reunited with the Catholic Church, etc., etc. But it was about a 25-year period of, you know, this wayward group trying what I really think was a social experiment that she tried. And it was a failure, needless to say. And it caused a lot of pain. And I'm not saying that we didn't have fun and do a lot of fabulously enjoyable things and things that I look back on to this day. And in a crazy way, Sister Catherine, for all of her dogmatic and doctrinaire and cruel upbringing, put a lot in me that helped me when I left, because failure was not an option. And as far as she was concerned, I was a failure because I was not going to be a good nun. So when I left the center, I felt as though I was a failure. But I said to myself, as I moved into this new world that I so desperately wanted to explore, I said to myself, failure is not an option. I didn't know what success would be, but all I knew was that I couldn't fail. In her own crazy way, she gave me some of the grounding that would allow me to move forward and, you know, pick up the pieces when things were difficult. As I say, there's luck and there's pluck. You have to work hard. Were there glass ceilings? Absolutely. But you have to find a way around that glass ceiling to get up the circular staircase. And by the time I retired from my life on Wall Street at the age of 51, I was a global partner at Invesco. And I could not have asked for a more rewarding, intellectually challenging career. And perhaps my best way of giving back these days is I mentor. I mentor young women, I mentor college students, and I try to support this notion that everyone's going to have pushback. Everyone's going to have hindrances. It will feel like a glass ceiling. It will feel like this or that. Just find people whom you can trust and who will be supportive. Find people. Be a seeker. And those people that come back and respond to you in good grace, take their advice. Ask them more questions. I mentor middle school girls in East Harlem at a Catholic school in East Harlem. And it is possibly one of the most favorite things I do.
So you're still religious?
I am Catholic. I am. I realize that the Catholic Church in particular has had horrific instances of abuse and bad behavior. But I also look at the Mother Teresa's of this world and say, there's nothing wrong with the religion per se. There are just good people and not good people.
Patricia Walsh Chadwick is the author of Little Sister, a Memoir. The paperback version is scheduled to be released April 28th and is published by Post Hill Press. Now, we head to West Virginia with producer Aaron Henkin, where according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the rate of opioid overdose deaths is nearly double the national average. In Charleston, West Virginia, the residential facility Recovery Point is doing what it can to stem the crisis, and the head of the organization has a very personal stake in the work they do.
My name is Fran Gray. We're currently at Recovery Point in Charleston, located on the west side. It is a 9 to 12 month abstinence-based program. Our participants live here the entire time. There's multiple parts of the program. There's detox, there's OTS-1, there's OTS-2, phase 1, and then a 3-month aftercare portion. And they are not allowed to leave until we actually have an approved home plan for them. We currently have 111 girls in the main facility. We have an 8-bedroom house right next across the street. And then we have a 24 complex apartment out back. So there's typically about 146 women here at any time. I was actually a participant here back in 2016. I was the first graduate of this program. So I started out from detox, so I've kind of worked my way up to the director's position now. It's really comforting to talk to someone and be like, me too. I've been there too, exactly where you're at. Most of the women don't believe that I'm in recovery, and I like that. They think that, you know, they can just see that my life's gotten significantly better and can't, you know, in that state of mind, imagine. I came from a small town. There was no drinking, no drugs in my house. No one even smoked. I got into a car accident back in 2010, and I was prescribed opiates at that time and put on a Dilaudid drip and morphine, and I had never used any type of opiates in my entire life. I had no idea that you could even get addicted. I was actually very judgmental towards people that had addiction. I always imagined that person as like the hobo under the bridge drinking a bottle. That's how I thought it. You know, I always did really well in school, had scholarships, everything else to go to college. But when I got into college after my car accident, I started, after the opiates were gone, I started drinking because I kind of started remembering like that feeling with it. I had lost my job at that point. I had lost my scholarship. So it just kind of went off from there. I ended up getting with a boy that was using at the same time too. And I was trying to save him essentially from it. I remember actually yelling at him to get up and suck it up because he was going through detox, because I just didn't understand. And at that point, I don't know, I just got to the point where I wanted to try to see what he was choosing over me. And from there, it just went off. I used IV heroin. First time I ever used heroin was IV, and I was instantly addicted. I used IV for about 18 months, and then what ended up happening is I got into trouble. I had a petty larceny charge. So, you know, I was looking at a situation where I was looking at 10 years in prison. From there, I was given a choice. I could either go to treatment, or I could stay in jail for a really long time. And so then November 14th, 2016, I came here. So I went through here and graduated and took a program honor position here. And recently, about 5 months ago, I moved into the director's position. I've actually, you know, working through here and finding myself, I learned a way to choose me. And I, you know, I have a new relationship today. And I actually had my daughter too while I've been in sobriety, and who's absolutely wonderful. I swear she's like the best baby ever. And I don't know, I've got to be not only stable in my family's life now and not worry my mother to death and my father to death. You know, I've been able to build my own family from there too. You know, I'm stable now. I own a house. I mean, that's something that, you know, has been a great achievement of mine. And, you know, to be a really good mom has been another achievement of mine.
Fran Gray is the director of Recovery Point on the west side of Charleston, West Virginia. This segment was by Out of the Blocks producer Aaron Henkin and featured music by Wendell Patrick. That's our show for this week. I'm Elizabeth Hill. Allison Dunn will be back next week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1599.